Okay, let's get started off. In the last class, we looked at amplifiers, and we're going to take a step forward and look at lasers, which are special kinds of amplifiers. It has amplifiers plus some positive feedback, which makes it particularly interesting. And we'll also look at other kinds of light sources, like LEDs, VCSELs, tunable lasers, and so on, and ask why are lasers used in fiber optics, and especially for high-speed communications. And why are these other technologies less preferable, and could they be preferable in other contexts, like free space optical communication context, for example? That's the goal of this lecture. So the target characteristics in a laser. Okay, why are we interested in lasers? Essentially, you want to get a stream of photons, and you want to modulate that, turn it on and off. That's a basic modulation capability on the fiber. But we saw fiber has some characteristics, right? It's dispersion limited. So because of dispersion, if I have the photons which are coming in or have a large bandwidth, the more the bandwidth you have, the left end of the range will get dispersed differently from the right end of the range. Okay, in fact, this is what's called dispersion. The refractive index depends upon the wavelength. So you will have intra-symbol interference, et cetera. So you'd like to get a source that is very tight in terms of its range, okay? And then you modulate it, and you have some band around it, but that's good enough, okay, for your transmission. You don't want a wide band, a source, okay? And then you want to have several sources, then you can essentially pick wavelength center frequencies and create small bands around it and do your stuff, okay? So that is the basic idea. So laser is such a light source. What is a laser? Laser is basically an optical amplifier, which we saw earlier, but it's enclosed in a reflective cavity. Okay, so in this sense, it is similar to the optical amplifier. It's also similar to the filter we saw, Fabry-Perot-Echelon. But the one key difference is not just both of them together. There's one more piece. You need to have a notion known as positive feedback. Okay, generally, when you learn control theory and so on, you know that negative feedback, stabilizing positive feedback is destabilizing and so on, right? You essentially increase this phenomena of amplification beyond a point to a point where this whole thing becomes spontaneous. Okay, you want to have stimulated emission, but it's also spontaneous. Okay, you saw spontaneous emission was different from stimulated emission, right? But what you want to have is you want to have spontaneous stimulated emission. So you don't actually insert any more power into it, but this still thinks still gives you amplification. Just it'll amplify any existing spontaneous emissions already there. So that is the basic idea. So you want to take one photon which comes out of spontaneous emission, and you want to get n photons out of it. And those are all coherent, and they go out in a particular manner which is guided by the laser design. And essentially out of the box comes coherent radiation without you pumping any more energy into the system. Okay, so the ideas are very similar. You still use the notion of population inversion, but you still use the notion of cavities and reflection and so on. But now we have to start talking about what is this positive feedback business. Okay, that is the key difference. Okay, so the first idea is that this positive feedback stuff, or what is known as the lasing threshold, does not occur at very low powers. There is a threshold of power which you have to pump into the system before which you get this positive feedback stuff. Okay, so, and this, the output powers are fairly high. I mean, it depends upon the application. If you just want to do basic transmission, you're talking about 1 to 10 milliwatts. And if you're trying to do EDFA type applications, you're talking about hundreds of milliwatts and a few watts for Raman pumps. So you need this threshold current to drive it to beyond the lasing threshold. And then once you have driven it above the threshold, you want to ask what is the efficiency, or what's known as the slope efficiency. It says, what is the ratio of output power to the drive current? So if I give you some more incremental current, what is the output I get? I mean, so you want a bigger bang for the buck beyond this point. And that is what lasers are interesting for. Not only do you get a bigger bang for the buck in terms of the output power, but you also get coherence, which is a new phenomenon I talked about. So these are two features. Okay, so you have a nonlinear amplification beyond a given threshold current, and you have the spontaneous, you have coherence. Okay, these are the two ideas. And also as a result of the whole thing, because it is a function of an underlying process, which is stimulated emission, it is generated around a particular lambda. Okay, So remember, it's very simple to understand. Suppose I have an optical amplifier, right, which operates by stimulated emission. It is going to give me a band of frequencies, okay. Then I use a filter, okay, and remember what a Bragg rating and a filter is. It basically cuts off some frequencies and keeps the frequency. And remember the way the fiber, the fabric around ferroethylene was working, was it had a, as you have higher and higher reflectivities, the gap becomes smaller and smaller. The bandwidth is very is tighter and tighter. So essentially, you use a high reflectivity based cavity to have a tight wavelength, and essentially, you also have this new coherence phenomena, which makes it even more tighter. Coherence occurs only when all the particles are emitted at the same, or exactly, or very close to the same wavelengths. Okay, so the spectral width, as a result, is very tight. Okay, the very narrow spectral widths at particular wavelengths. It you can you'll also see that there's a multiple longitudinal mode laser, which has it at some multiples of this wavelength. Or you can have a single longitudinal mode which just gives you one line, and these are the two types of lasers. So you'd like to get this specific lambda, and then around the other lambdas you want to suppress. Okay, so that means in the frequency domain we call these as side lobes. Okay, you want to kill these side lobes, and you want to understand what is the ratio between the side lobes and the main lobe, which is called the side mode or side lobe suppression ratio. And tunable laser can operate at different frequencies, depending upon the structure of the laser, and then you want to be able to tune it. Okay, and one asks how quickly you can tune it, how accurately you can tune it, etc. The other aspect of lasers is because you're trying to remember when we studied nonlinear effects and so on, we talked about chirping, and if the laser is chirp, I mean does not have a fixed, suppose I'm sending a laser which is operating at a particular lambda, and then it drifts. Okay, the actual lambda which it produces, if it drifts, what will happen is it will cause crosstalk and so on. So the energy from one band can go into the other band and so on. So that is one aspect. The other aspect is if it creates chirping or unduly large chirping at higher modulation speeds, you'll have to use external modulators. Otherwise, this chirping can interact with chromatic dispersion and cause spreads. Okay, so. So the overall goal is people have tried to produce lasers which can modulate up to a reasonable point internally, and then they use external modulators, but the overall focus is on wavelength stability, narrow line widths, single mode versus single longitudinal modes versus multiple longitudinal mode, and the overall efficiency characteristics and what is the minimum current. So lasers are higher power devices. Remember, you have to put higher power in to get higher power out. Okay, lower power, I mean, nothing happens. Okay, so recall how the whole thing works again. Okay, we talked about this in last class. Essentially, there is this notion of emission, and it could be spontaneous or stimulated, and this emission corresponds to an energy being given out as a quanta, and that energy is contained in a photon, which is light, okay, of particular wavelength. So, the pumping behavior can occur in several ways. You can have level 1 absorption to go to level 3, and then some phonon being given out, and then a photon being given out from level 2 to level 1, or you can have other types of transitions like level 1 to 4, 4 to 3 phonon, 3 to 2 photon, and then 2 to 1 phonon. Okay, these kinds of things can happen. It all depends upon the system or the appropriate substrate you're working with. Okay, there can also be other complicated multi-level energy system where you do pumping, and then depending upon where you pump, you can have different types of behavior. It can generate one wavelength. You can generate one frequency of light, and then also the other frequency of light. So here you can actually have use these facts and operate in two bands because of this. Okay, these are features you can use. Man, this picture is pretty bad. Okay, if you have your slides, please take a look at this picture. So this is a nice drawing of the difference between spontaneous emission and I think the next slide will talk about stimulated emission. Yeah. Okay, spontaneous emission essentially means you have emissions or photons that's drawn by this dual wave particle diagrams. They can go in different directions, different phases, and they are all random phases and so on and so forth. Okay. And metastable states are the ones which are not totally stable, but they can give out a photon and then hang out for a while, okay, and then wait to be stimulated. And then once you're stimulated, you have two identical photons which are going. Now, So basic idea of stimulated emission is you have an atom in a ground state and you excite it through a pump, and it is now in an excited state, which is basically population inversion, and then you have an arriving photon of the appropriate frequency or wavelength, and then you have two identical photons which are given out. Okay. Now, the other aspect we talked about earlier was the Fabry-Perot cavity, okay, which is given this fancy name called etalon. The basic idea is it was a filter. Okay, you had this filtering effect, and what happened was that you had a standing wave between these two cavity elements. So, basic idea. I think the way I explained it to you was interference, right? So, you have a wave that comes here. Okay, and the wave goes out. Part of the wave is reflected. Part of the wave goes out. Okay, and this amount of wave that is reflected and which goes out depends upon the reflectivity of these mirrors. Okay, which is captured by the parameter R. So now part of the wave goes out. Okay, now the thing is reflected and reflected again. Okay, and this reflected. So after one reflection, you have a wave that is going out, and then this wave is superimposed or interferes with the original wave that went out. Okay, so essentially now you have waves that are out of phase, and the degree of out of phase depends upon this cavity length. Okay, so you have half. Suppose this half wavelength and half wavelength, right? So that particular wave will superimpose constructively, the other fellows will superimpose destructively, and depending upon the wavelength selectivity of the mirror as well as the reflectivity, which is absolute reflectivity of the mirror, it will determine the interference patterns that are coming out, and these interference patterns basically will start having the sink kind of shape, and it will start forming a sharp peaks here. So as you have higher and higher reflectivities, which are not obvious from this slide here, but if you look at your slides diagrams, you see as you go to higher reflectivity, you have tighter tighter bandwidth of the echelon. Okay, so laser works in a similar manner. Okay, you are essentially creating, LED works in a similar manner, and laser also works in a similar manner. You can understand both of these as though they are these cavities. In an LED, right, you provide a low reflectivity cavity. So if I have a high reflectivity cavity, you will have a potential of positive feedback. In a low reflectivity cavity, you don't have that potential. So you never build up stimulated emission to the point where there's substantial positive feedback. And we'll study this positive feedback business in a moment. So essentially, the way you're creating this cavity is just through a simple PN junction, which is forward biased. Okay, you create a forward biased PN junction, and the recombination of the injected minority carriers in this forward biased thing will cause emission. Okay, so once you combine that, that will lead to a spontaneous emission of light, which is incoherent. And it has a broad spectrum, and it could be understood the spectrum is broad because it's like a low reflectivity Fabry-Perot cavity. And it's also low power. You don't throw a lot of power out also. Okay, and the internal modulation rates, like turning it on and off, is around 100 megabit per second max. In fact, theoretically, you can go up to 1 or 2 gigabit per second, but in practice, we talk about hundreds of megabit per second of modulation rates. Okay, so you could, so suppose whenever you get something which is broad bandwidth, right, you could put another filter in front of it, like a Bragg grating, and tighten the bandwidth that comes off. So in the sense that if I get a tighter bandwidth, it's still not coherent. Coherent also means the phases have to add up and be, okay. But you can still not worry about full coherence, but you want to have tight bandwidth. One way you can do it is you can put a tight filter after the LED and get a small bandwidth out of it. The flip side is that the energy in the other bands will be lost. Okay, what a filter does is it gives you the broad band, the short bandwidth, but it eats up the energies in the other bands. Okay, because the LED itself gives you low power, and if you eat up most of its power and just give you a small band, it's not very great. What you like is that you like all the power to be concentrated in that low band. Okay, that's what laser gives you. So you want a high power output because you can go farther, okay, for long distance communications, and you like to have a sharper spectrum primarily because you want to avoid dispersion issues. If I have a broader spectrum, you immediately have more dispersion. So tighter spectrum, which is given to you by this coherence phenomena, gives you a better control over chromatic dispersion. And then I mean, what you really want is actually just the tight band of frequencies. I mean, the coherence gives you more things. It gives you phase coherence, polarization coherence, and so on, which are all bonuses. I mean, you can use that to your benefit as well. So you can do internal or external modulation with these things. If you want to do external modulation, if you want to go for higher distance and longer, more bit rates, you'd go for external modulation. Internal modulation means that the basic laser thing, right, you're adding a drive current. You can actually reduce the drive current, and so you either laser at a higher power or laser at a lower power. Okay, so that is called internal modulation. Another way is to not bother about internally modulating, just have a light which is unmodulated laser light, just block it open. So this is what an external modulator does. And I think we can use electro-optic effects like lithium niobate and so on to do external modulation at very, very high speeds. If you're not studying, we'll do it later. Okay, there are two types of lasers, okay, and if a laser works on the cavity idea, right, if you notice the cavity thing, can we go to the slides, please? Yeah, if you look at the cavity here, you see there are multiple lines here. Okay, and even if you tighten this, right, I would initially call this multiple bands, okay, and the separation of these bands is known as a free spectral range, or FSR, and so this is known as a multiple longitudinal mode lasers, okay, or MLM lasers. Okay, we have encountered this name before. I'll tell you where we encountered it, actually. Shucks, I don't have this thing. I forgot, yeah. Actually, in one of the earlier pictures, we said that multiple longitudinal mode lasers were originally discovered after LEDs, okay? Semiconductor lasers were discovered. So they would have a behavior like this. They would give you a power spectrum like this. And you would use that on, say, some transmission medium like 1.3 micrometer thing, and then you would use regenerators and so on. So MLM lasers were used for short haul and medium speed applications. And as you wanted to do higher speed application, you went to SLM laser that provides a single line, okay, and you also move to a better fiber, 1.5 micrometer, and then later we started doing optical amplifiers like EDFAs, and now you can not only have longer length of fibers, you can also have multiple wavelengths. Okay, so that was the history, right? So MLM was the original thing in terms of lasers. So MLM is also a class of lasers. Let's see where we are. Okay. Okay. So the idea of LEDs is again very simple. Okay, so you have a positive or a negative bias. If you use a reverse biased p-n junction, it's a photodetector. If you use a positive biased p-n junction, it becomes an LED. Okay, but LED is becoming more of an art right now because it's also being used in applications for lighting and so on. So in the future, you're going to have solid state lighting. It's going to be much more efficient than these things, and also provide. So essentially what you want is light. LED can give you light, right? So you can convert the light to be white. The biggest problem is getting white light out of LEDs. You can get all other kinds of light out of LEDs. Okay, anyway, so we have a lighting center at RPI. Professor Fred Schubert actually leads lighting research, LED research at RPI. So LEDs is not just a simple thing. So there are all kinds of new LEDs which function almost close to lasers. They have resonant cavities, and so LEDs typically are thought of as having a broader spectrum, but you can get tighter spectrums, better modulation characteristics even with LEDs. So LEDs are becoming closer and closer to lasers as we speak. Okay, anyway, the basic idea of LEDs is you still have this notion of a band gap and this energy differences, and you have these charge carriers which can move from one band to the other. Okay. And this band gap is usually measured in electron volts. Okay, one electron volt is, I think, roughly the energy of an electron, single electron, I think. Okay, so this band gap also determines what is the frequency of light that's going to be emitted. And the band gap is essentially built as this is the junction area, which is the band, which is the point where this recombination occurs, and you emit light out of this region. Okay, so there are versions of LEDs. I'm not going to go into great detail, but if I want to produce a more localized area and better reflection, okay, I can use another LED design known as a double heterojunction LED. Okay, heterojunction means that you use different materials here, and if you look at the band gap structure of it, you will see that the band gap of the junction area is smaller than the surrounding area. Okay, what this means is if I have a light that is coming here, which is smaller than this band gap. Okay, when I say light and energy, I'll use it equivalently. If I have a light of a wavelength coming, if it's smaller than that energy, it'll just pass through. That's why it's transparent. Whenever light passes through, it means that the light that passes through is smaller than the band gap of the material that's used. So if I have a large band gap material, you can have light, just a lot of light will pass through. Okay. So, and remember that more energy also means lower wavelength. So you can provide lower and lower wavelength, which means far infrared and so on. So today a lot of the, when you use large band gap materials, you are trying to get far infrared LEDs. And why do you care about far infrared LEDs? Because in free space communication, far infrared has greater, better propagation characteristics. And there are other applications too. And so on. Anyway, so but the point here is that the charge carriers are attracted to this region, okay? And in this region, so charge carriers from here and here are attracted to this region, and charge carriers from here and here are attracted to this region. And so they're essentially trapped here, and all the recombination essentially occurs here. So this is a much more efficient recombination method by using the double heterojunction. So you have one junction here and the junction here. Okay, this is basically some kind of a doped indium phosphide and indium gallium arsenide phosphide. It's a ternary compound. I'm sorry, quaternary. Okay, so there are issues with LEDs. LEDs are sort of very fickle. Anything can affect them. So you have a temperature that can affect the type of intensity curve. So this is the sort of spectrum of this LED. If I look at the spectrum of the LED, you can have a somewhat of a tight spectrum. I mean, it's not very tight for optical, for fiber transmissions. But it starts becoming weaker and also broader as you go for higher temperatures. So even a small change in temperature, like 5 degrees centigrade, at higher temperatures, this whole thing becomes less useful. Okay, and this can cause, if you have changes in temperatures in your device, I mean, this can cause wavelength drift, and it'll cause the same usual interference or symbol interferences. Okay, and I'm not going to talk about this, but so these are problems, basic problems with LEDs. So LEDs have been pretty much discounted as far as fiber optical communications go. Okay, they are used in very, very short haul, low speed communications, but they're not used in any high speed business. So if you look at the spectral widths of these LEDs, these are becoming tighter and tighter depending upon better LED designs. But in general, the spectral widths, as you go further and further, they are broader and broader. Okay, so in fact, the output power at particular wavelengths has a sort of inverse dependency. So if you go larger thing, you have, larger wavelength, you have lesser power output and so on and so forth. Okay, so there is, today we are investigating the use of LEDs in free space optical communication. Okay, so we have a project in free space optical communication, and we re-examine why not use LEDs, because the reason why lasers are being used is for their, because the fiber is dispersion limited. Okay, if you go in thin air, the refractive index is very close to 1. It is not like 1.5 like in fiber, and also it doesn't vary dramatically depending upon the wavelength. Okay, so as a result, the dispersion effects are far, far lesser compared to fiber. So you can go back and revisit the question, what is the right set of light sources to use? Okay, but there are other issues. I mean, not only is it, so spectral width is less important in free space optics, especially if you're looking at lower speed communication. But more important is what are the propagation characteristics, what are the absorption characteristics. So if you go to higher and higher frequencies, you know that there are Rayleigh scattering and so on and so forth. So blue gets scattered more and so on. So so there is a trade-off in terms of choice of sources. Okay, so one of the biggest issues which people study in fiber optics is how to select the sources which are well matched to the fiber, so that you minimize dispersion issues. Okay, so we basically looked at LEDs so far. So what are lasers, and how are they different from optical amplifiers which we saw earlier? So we saw that as the reflectivity of the cavity boundaries of the fabry-perot cavity, which are also called facets, as they increase, the gain is high only for the resonant frequencies, or resonant wavelengths of the cavity. Okay, and the resonant wavelengths are where it's an integral multiple of half wavelength. Okay, So all these resident fellows will add in phase, and all the others will not be will die out. Okay, and the gain in general is a sort of function of the actual wavelength of the reflectivity, which corresponds to the various curves we saw. Okay, now if the reflectivity is very high, okay, and the gain is sufficiently high, okay, now a special phenomena occurs. Okay, what happens is that you can produce light even in the absence of further input signal. Okay, so this is called the lasing threshold. So you raise the reflectivity and you have pumped in a lot of light, threshold current into this whole thing, or threshold amount of photons into this whole thing. So beyond this point, the laser is no longer a mere amplifier, but it becomes an oscillator. Okay, an oscillator has resonant frequencies. Okay, and then essentially what it means is that any spontaneous emission that comes out of the system will be amplified, and it will have sort of a permanent permanent population inversion. So the population inversion becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. Okay, that is the idea. So the simple way to think about it is the following. Even if you send one photon in, right, it will keep bouncing around and around and around. So what will happen is it will keep stimulating other photons as it goes in either way. Okay, and at some point it will get out, it's gone. Okay, but while it's inside the cavity, it's going to be inside the cavity for a long time. And while it's inside the cavity, it has a lot of opportunity to stimulate other photons, right? So so at that point, a lot of other photons will be stimulated, and many photons will happen. So now this whole thing adds up. Every photon that is stimulated will go again and do reflection. And so the number of photons basically build up. And even though this thing is very, very high reflectivity, what goes out will be, because you've just built up so much stimulated emission inside the system, what goes out will be very high power as well as extremely coherent. Okay, so that is the idea. So this is called, that's why a laser is called light amplification. So it's an amplifier by stimulated emission of radiation. Okay. So another way to think about this is you have, instead of having random directions to this whole thing, you get energy. This energy makes sure you keep a critical threshold of population inversion, and beyond that, any spontaneous emission also goes up and down like this in the cavity. There's some amount which is lost, because if you don't go perfectly up and down in the cavity, you're basically lost. You'll just be lost somewhere. But whatever goes up and down builds up here, and a small fraction gets out. But even that is a huge power. That is the basic idea of thing. And one way to understand the resonant frequencies is you can think of these as standing waves between the two cavities. And standing waves can occur if you have half wavelength or one wavelength or one and a half wavelengths or some integral multiple of wavelengths. Okay, that is why these things are called longitudinal modes. Okay, you should make sure you may understand the difference between longitudinal modes and lateral modes. When we talked about fiber, we talked about modal dispersion. Okay, modal dispersion occurs because you had the sort of standing waves as you had this total internal reflection as it went end to end, and therefore you had the bit energy was getting spread out over time because of these different modes taking longer distances. But here longitudinal modes here are within a Fabry-Perot cavity, and longitudinal modes here refer to this characteristic frequency at which these standing waves occur. In other words, it'll occur. It also talks about the characteristic frequency at which light will be emitted, coherent light will be emitted. So you can have multiple longitudinal modes or a single longitudinal mode, which is the MLM and SLM lasers. So if I have a gain spectrum which is wide, you will not have, unlike an LED, which you'll a pattern which looks like this. But interestingly, what you'll have is you'll have an envelope which looks like this, and you'll have a whole bunch of modes which will behave like this. Okay, so essentially you're seeing modes here, particular modes, and these modes are the difference between the modes correspond to the sort of cavity length and so on. But also the power of each of these modes also has this Gaussian profile. So the envelope of these modes look like this. And there is a term here called FF. What is this? Full wave? I never get this. FWHM. Okay, so it's just a measure of the spectral width. I keep forgetting what this thing is. And then the line, each line you can measure the same quantity. It just tries to measure the spectrum, the width of that of that mode. Okay, so this is the basic idea. Now, so this is a multi-longitudinal mode laser. Now you can create, so essentially what you want to do is you create a Fabry-Perot cavity with really nice reflection properties, and you want to sort of pump energy into it. How do you do it? You essentially take a p-n junction and do it. You take a heterojunction like what we did like that last time, and you create beautiful mirrors here through heterojunctions. And you can, there are several ways of fabricating mirrors between these two points. And then as you pump energy into this by positively biasing this, once you start having a lasing threshold is crossed, the mirrors are created at the edges of these things. That's why it's called an edge-emitting laser. So you have the p-n junction, which is like this, but then the mirrors are like this. So the reflection goes up and down this way, and finally light goes out this way. So light goes out from the edge of this thing. And that way, it is fairly confined. Okay, one of the issues is you want to couple light from the laser source into the fiber, right? If the light is going in a broad spatial dimension, it's very hard to couple. You need to put a lens, etc., right? So the edge emitting is nice for the coupling phenomena. So the if you look at how this multi-longitudinal mode will behave, it'll look like pretty much like a LED for a while, which has a broad spectrum, and then below the threshold it'll look like this. And when it's the full power above the threshold, it's still Gaussian, but these other things are dramatically suppressed. So you have a primary mode that looks like this. You can also estimate this by looking at the drive current versus light output curve. If you look at LEDs, the curve will be like this, somewhat like this, or it will be linear or something like that, okay, depending upon the types of LEDs you use. If you use a basic LED, you will have a linear type behavior because of spontaneous emission. You pump more power, you'll have more stimulated, more spontaneous emission, that's what you'll get, not much stimulated emission. If you use a resonant cavity LED, it will start looking like a laser. And if you have a laser, you have this nonlinear phenomenon. So a laser is characterized by this nonlinear jump, and this threshold is known as this lasing threshold. Okay, so laser will always have a nonlinear drive current to light output curve. Okay, so the other issue is once you've created this beautiful light, you want to guide it. Okay, if you have an unguided thing, the light output comes in a broad spectrum. So what you can do is you can design your the laser such that you can index guide it. Okay, you can do some gain guiding by having you can kill some of this light which comes on some other sides, or you can index guide it by changing the refractive index of the material here. Essentially, you're creating a small cavity here. So these are varieties of ways of creating creating small cavities and also localizing the way light comes in. Okay, so the actually optical networking started taking off with the use of lasers, because now you can transmit larger distances, higher bandwidths, higher modulation rates. But still, multi-longitudinal mode lasers are not as good as the single-longitudinal mode lasers, okay, which essentially has one line. Okay, and here you can have multiple lines. Okay, so this is another similar figure. Okay, how do you create a single longitudinal mode lasers? Okay, the answer is very simple. You have multiple lines, right? You just kill the other lines. That is the way you do it. Okay, and one way to kill it is to put a filter. Okay, and what is a filter? A filter is like a Bragg grating or some sort of a grating that just sends that part in and the rest out. Okay, rest of them are killed. So essentially what you do is you put a Bragg grating. You take a laser, which is essentially the thing I told, like a p-n junction with a clear mirrors and so on, and so I think this is better to understand. This is known as a DBR, distributed Bragg reflector laser. What it does is you have a gain medium, you have lasing here, and then the lasing output comes out in this direction, and this corrugation essentially acts as a mirror. Okay, so you have some mirrors here, and only the Bragg condition which is satisfied as you go through this through a set of corrugations. Only for that, those lambdas for which the Bragg condition is satisfied, those will get out. Okay, it's a simple way of thinking about it. And the other fellows are either thrown out or killed. Okay, so there are two varieties of this thing. One is known as a distributed Bragg grating, Bragg reflector laser, where the corrugation is outside the gain medium. And the other one is called distributed fiber Bragg laser, where the corrugation is within the gain medium. So But the latter has become more popular because you'd like to have the gain medium as small as possible, the corrugations can be outside. Okay, so both these lasers together are called distributed feedback lasers. Okay, so essentially you have a feedback that not only occurs within the gain medium, you also have feedback that occurs between these Bragg reflectors. Okay, so you have so it's basically like this. You have one cavity and you have energy that is getting out of this, lased energy that's getting out, and then the lased energy has to satisfy the cavity conditions of the next cavity, otherwise it will be killed. So you have lasing at the next cavity, and only then it gets out. Okay, that's the basic idea. And the same idea we saw earlier, even though we didn't understand it fully, in the Raman amplifier, Raman pump source. So essentially the same idea has been created in the fiber, where you had different types of mirrors. Okay, you can use these corrugations are essentially like mirrors, which can be lambda sensitive, wavelength sensitive mirrors and so on. Okay, so that is like a distributed feedback laser. Okay, so the takeaway message is that a laser uses a cavity, and it will create with a high reflectivity a critical drive current to create the lasing threshold and a positive feedback that using stimulated emission. Once you have that, you get a multi-longitudinal mode laser, and you want to kill the modes by using a distributed reflection or distributed feedback method. Okay, so this is another diagram of the same thing. This is also called a Bragg grater or a DBR laser. That's what it's called. Okay, so the way it's fabricated is that you have a PN junction basically followed by a bunch of Bragg reflectors or corrugations or whatever. Okay, another way to do it is to take a laser and keep it separately, and then take a lens and make the light go through a fiber Bragg grating, which will get the similar effect. Okay, but these are sort of nice to fabricate and so on. So in a single structure you can fabricate this whole thing. Another way to do it is you remember that erbium dope business, which is also doing amplification. So if you put a grating or reflector on both sides, it'll become a laser. That's why you wanted to put an isolator in front of it. So you don't really want it to become a laser. So the problem, one might ask, laser amplifies more than an optical amplifier. Why don't you just make erbium doped amplifier a laser? What is the problem in making the EDFA a laser? So if I let the reflected light come back and make it laser, what will happen? So why don't I want the erbium EDFA to become a laser? You see my question? See, when I talked about EDFAs, I said the goal of EDFAs was to amplify. And lasers also amplify, don't they? Okay. So why don't I want, and lasers amplify better than just a basic amplifier? Yeah. So the answer was the laser gives you a thin spectral width and EDFA gives you wider. No, that's not the right answer. Yeah, think about it. It's fairly straightforward actually. So think about it. So you're having your signals coming in, okay, and you have this thing in the middle called an EDFA, which is providing amplification. Why don't I just replace that with an EDFA that becomes a laser, okay? So why don't I do that? Sorry? Cost considerations. No, it's not cost considerations. It's actually very straightforward.
So EDFA has to amplify over the whole band?
It has nothing to do with the band. So, he also said the same thing. It has to amplify over the band. It's not the band. Band is one issue, but that's not the primary reason. Any other ideas?
I just get output at one wavelength.
Yeah, see. Well, you get output at one, it's not wavelength. The thing is, when you have laser, right, when you're having a signal, the meaning of signal is a modulated entity. You have a series of zeros and ones that are coming. If you pass it through an element that again lasers, it'll just give you ones. You see? So all your information is lost. It's not amplified. You see what I mean? So, if I have a lasing instrument somewhere in between, which takes a signal, so whether it's zeros or ones, right, it will just create ones out. Okay, if you happen to get if you happen to pass the aliasing threshold, so the modulations will be completely ignored. So you will have, so you send in a sequence of zeros and ones and you're getting ones out. So it has nothing to do with the bandwidth. I mean, bandwidth is one issue, but that's why you don't want to have, that's why you need an isolator in front of it. Okay, so, but you can create a piece, I mean, if you want to really a laser and not an erbium doped amplifier, you can create a fiber section that has erbium doped, and then you can put a Bragg grating on both sides, and that will also create, give you a laser. So on. So the other way of doing lasers is known as external cavity lasers. This is almost a similar principle. Basically, the goal is that if I have two cavities, right, the light, the lasing wavelengths that pass through has to satisfy the Bragg, satisfy the Fabry-Pérot conditions for both these cavities. Just like you had Fabry-Pérot followed by grating conditions, here you have to satisfy Fabry-Pérot conditions for both cavities. So that will kill out all the other wavelengths, and only those particular wavelengths will pass through. So these are external cavity lasers are used at for high-speed test equipment and so on. And by the way, this you can also tune this, because by tuning the external cavity width either mechanically, or you can actually tune the width by using a piezoelectric material and actually giving it some temperature so that the effective distance has changed, so the effective cavity length has changed. So what that will do is you will suddenly change the actual, so if you get a multi-longitudinal mode, instead of selecting this mode, you'll select the other mode. You see? So by changing cavity lengths through various tricks, you can essentially select different modes of the multi-longitudinal modes, and that gives you a tunable laser. So depending upon what are the electro-optic effects or optical effects you use to, you do that function, you get a speed at which you can tune. But today the tuning capabilities are only available few milliseconds, or that's the max, that's the best tuning you get. So this external cavity laser is obviously using test equipment, because you'd like to use the same piece of laser and go and test multiple things, which might require different lasing behavior. So that's why it's used in test equipment. It's obviously much more costlier. Okay, so we saw a bunch of lasers. There's another category of lasers known as VCSELs cells. Okay, and these are becoming enormously popular for short haul and medium haul applications as we speak. Okay, this stands, VCSEL stands for what is known as vertical cavity surface emitting lasers. Okay, so there are two ways of thinking about this. It's a laser, okay, and it's a surface emitting laser. Okay, instead of edge emitting, light instead of coming out of the edge will come out of the surface itself of the PN junction. Okay, that's one way of thinking about it. The other issue, why do you want to make light come out of the surface? Okay, so if you study the longitudinal mode spacing formula, which I didn't go through, but it depends basically upon the Bragg, upon the Fabry-Pérot distances, it has a formula that looks like C by 2 NL, where N is the refractive index and L is the spacing between the mirrors. Okay, so if I want to get a single mode laser, either I can kill out, I can get a multi-mode laser and then kill out the modes, or I can make the cavity length so small, L so small, that only one mode will come out. Okay, so that's one way of doing it. So so people explored this idea and said, let me create a very thin cavity. Okay, and in semiconductor or PN junctions, it's known as a very thin active layer. So if you create a very thin active layer, this can be done through current lithography techniques. You can basically create a thin active layers by depositing one on top of the other. Okay, so by this, essentially, if you make these fellows reflecting at the top and bottom, you'll have a thin cavity here, and light will come out this way. So so through standard lithography and epitaxy and so on, you can create thin layers. And for getting high mirrors, right, reflectively mirrors, you do a trick by actually depositing a stack of alternating low and high index reflectors. Okay, I won't go into the details of this. So essentially, I think I have one more figure here. So you have a stack of reflectors here, which essentially behave like as though they are distributed Bragg reflectors. So you have reflection here, reflection here, reflection here. So essentially, you've created not only a much more smaller cavity here, you get fewer modes out, and even that modes can be killed by just a few reflectors Rayleigh factors here. Okay, but now the problem is that all the light will start coming out through your surface, okay, and in a small cone. Okay, now the issue with this class of lasers was that it has the way it is built. I won't go into details, but it has a huge heat dissipation problem because of the ohmic resistance in that. Only recently have people built VCSELs in the interesting bands like 1.3 micrometers and more recently in the 1.5 micrometer band, which are uncooled, okay, room temperature lasers. Okay, and the usual VCSELs are operated at much lower things like 800.8 micrometer or 800 nanometers. There are lots of VCSELs available. So if you want to do short haul applications like within a building and so on, you can, or if you want to do an interconnect between two racks, say we learned about the switching or high speed switches or high speed routers, or you want to connect these two, you can put a 800.8 micrometer fiber there and use VCSELs to do that short haul thing. Okay, so why are they attractive? Okay, I'm just going to skip some of this. The reason they're attractive is because they can be fabricated easily. You can create lots of them, or you can create huge arrays of them very well. So they have a high yield if you want to create. I mean, you can make them small and high yield. Now, the problem is, the yield problem turns around is you can actually create a tunable laser in the following manner. You can create different VCSELs. Each VCSEL has a different lambda at which it will emit. Okay. Now, what you want to do is, suppose you want to tune, you don't have to do any fancy thing like using piezoelectric material and all. Just turn off one laser, open the and turn on the other one, because you can fabricate it all in very close, in a very tiny space, it will work. Okay, so you can create a wavelength selective VCSEL array. Okay, but once you create arrays, your yield goes down dramatically. Or in other words, if you create this whole bunch, if one of them is dead, the whole array is useless. Okay, so. And for free space applications, optical applications, you can combine VCSEL powers. VCSELs are better than LEDs because they provide higher power. That's the idea for laser, right? So you can take VCSELs, which are not only coherent, but also higher power. And you can take many VCSELs and essentially use some kind of a lens system to get high power. If high power is the only thing you care about and reasonable tightness and spectrum, you can use that, okay. And so you can take VCSELs today, which operate at 800 nanometer or 1.3 micrometer ranges, which are essentially starting at near infrared, far infrared, combine them using a VCSEL matrix, and then use an external modulator here, or use synchronous internal modulation here for free space communication. So free space optical communication, we can reconsider VCSELs because you can create this array business out of them, and you can combine the power, because what you really care about in those applications is total output power and total output power which you can modulate, rather than the issues such as dispersion. The dispersion is affected by the fiber. I mean, if you take fiber, you need to operate in 1.55 micrometer band because it has better attenuation and better dispersion characteristics. Okay, so another type of lasers is known as mode-locked lasers. Okay. So here the idea is that you'd like to match the phase of the longitudinal modes, and these are useful for an application known as OTDM, or optical time division multiplexing. Okay, we'll not get into OTDM, I believe, by the end of this class. So okay, let me see. I don't know whether I want to cover this thing. Okay, let's skip this particular thing. Okay, so so mode-lock lasers, don't worry about it, but the other class of lasers which we are interested in is tunable lasers, because so when you say all optical networking, because whenever you say optical networking, and this course says optical networking, there are several facets of optical networking. When we started talking about fiber-based transmission, that's immediately optical networking. And then you started doing SONET, which is a synchronous optical network. Okay, so but it's pretty much an electronic standard that specifies multiplexing and going. Now we're talking about all optical components which completely operate in the optical domain, and you get. And then you have wave division multiplexing that helps you get from a single fiber lots of bandwidth, lots of effective capacity by using different bands and so on. But when you want to go beyond, but all of these are still limited to a single link. From one optoelectronic component to another optoelectronic component, you can get lots of bandwidth. It's a single link. But if I want to go and build an entire network that is all optical, that is even the switches are all optical, and then end to end my light doesn't get converted to electronics, okay? And that, what are the components necessary for that? The first type of component you need for that is tunable lasers, okay? Lasers that can be tuned to different wavelengths. Why? Then what you can do is, on a first hop, you can choose one wavelength, lambda 1, okay? Send your signal on that. And then you can use something known as a wavelength converter, which will take the energy from that, all in the optical domain, and transfer it to another, say, output. Okay, the switching is done in all optical manner. We'll talk about all optical switches like MEMS and other things a little bit later. And then the laser itself, which goes in the output, can be sent, can use a different wavelength. So the laser, if it's tunable, it gives me more flexibility. If it's a non-tunable, then the degree of sharing of this scarce resource, which is wavelengths, I just have like 50 wavelengths or 160 wavelengths max at every channel. So if I want to nail down wavelengths at every hop, I don't want to expect that the same wavelength is there in one or in every hop. So I want to be able to convert, send traffic on one wavelength, convert it to another wavelength, and so on and so forth. So the key component there is wavelength converters, and we need tunable lasers. So tunable lasers are the key enabler of something beyond DWDM. Okay, and unfortunately in this class, even though I wanted to cover it, I don't think I'm going to go into it in great depth, but if you're interested, you can take a look at the detail, the later chapters of the book, which are such as reconfigurable optical networks, or what is touted as all optical networks. Obviously, it's a dream today, optical routers and so on. There are real companies which are like Sycamore and so on, which does some of the stuff, but to get end-to-end capability in a deployed situation, we don't have many examples of it. So it's an emerging technology at this point, but that's what it is. Okay, so the key, so it's, we are at the component level. What's a tunable laser? I'd like to rapidly tune it, and once I have tuned it, I want it to be stable at that wherever I've tuned it in that band, and I want a wide and continuous range over which I'd like to tune it, so like around 100 nanometers. Okay, and I want it to be, this tuning itself should not kill its lifetime. Lasers themselves have, in terms of their lifetime, they're not as good as LEDs. LEDs, just can exist for years and years together. I mean, they have lifetimes of 10 years or something like that. That's why if you use LEDs in your street bulbs, the street lights, or actually the green lights and red, green and yellow lights, they use LEDs. I mean, those things never die. I mean, at least LEDs don't die. They're very, very long lasting. So I don't know whether you've seen in Hoosick streets, there are some of these traffic lights which are much more brighter. They actually use new high brightness LED technologies. But LEDs typically have much longer lifetimes. Lasers have shorter lifetimes, and because they're operated at higher power, they need to operate beyond the threshold drive current. And sometimes they have catastrophic failures. Okay, so these are two problems with lifetimes of lasers. But you sort of live with them, but this tuning itself should not degrade the lifetime further, okay, which is an issue depending upon the kind of tunable laser. And you want to be able to easily control and manufacture it. So there are different ways of again doing this. You can do electro-optical tuning by changing the refractive. So most of this is by doing refractive index games, okay. So you change the refractive index by injecting a current, okay, or an electric field. So that will affect the refractive index of the material. Or you can do temperature tuning by applying, depending upon the material, like a piezoelectric material, etc., you can change the temperature, and that will change some characteristics of that device. Either it should be refractive index, or maybe the effective length of the device, and so. Or you can use mechanical tuning like MEMS. Okay, so so the way to do tunable lasers, simple way to think about it is to think about it like the external cavity laser, right? So if I have one cavity, I have the lasing wavelengths that come out, and then I have to go through another cavity, and I get the wavelength. Right? So if I can change the characteristics of that a second cavity, external cavity, then I can do other things. So the way it is done to build like tunable lasers is you essentially have two or three sections. One section is known as the gain section, in which the lasing actually occurs. And then in the second section, you have a grating, which the characteristics of the grating can be controlled. Okay, the grating can either be a cavity, or it can be a reflective based system, and you can control that independently. Okay, so you have a gain current and then a Bragg current to control this this thing. Okay, by tuning this, you can tune, figure out what is the wavelength that comes out. Okay. Now, you can, in addition, you can have a three-section DBR laser that also has phase control in addition to both gain control as well as the wavelength control. Okay, so that is the basic idea. And again, if you look at a semiconductor picture, you can have a gain medium followed by a grating medium, and you have separate, electrodes here so that you can control the currents here, or you can have a three section. One section is known as the active or gain section. The other section is known as the phase section to control the phasing, and the other part is the Bragg section to control the tuning. Okay, so so the other idea is to use what is known as a sampled grating DBR. Instead of having a single grating, you can have a grating followed by a flat area which is not a grating, and then you can have a grating followed by another flat area which is not a grating. Okay, this is also sometimes called combs, so because the diagram looks like combs. Okay, so essentially, this is another way of getting it. Okay, I'm not going to go into the physical characteristics of it. Okay, so that is about lasers. To sum up on lasers, the idea is that beyond amplification, you are going to higher reflectivity, and you have to cross that critical current threshold to get sufficient positive feedback, which can be understood in several ways, like the same photon jumping up and back, and each run it is stimulating other photons, or existing spontaneous emissions also amplified, and so on and so forth. Okay, and whatever comes out, even though the reflectivity is very, very high, it is coherent. Okay, so the feedback aspect and the threshold aspects are very important in lasers. So, and that's what differentiates from amplifiers. And LEDs do not have such feedback. They are low reflectivity, so you never have this buildup of positive feedback, and the whole thing is incoherent. And the other aspects are, we saw about VIC cells, tunable lasers, okay, and we sort of skipped mode lock lasers. Okay, the other, the next part is sources. Now you're talking about detectors. Okay, now detectors, at least for fiber optics, is still more straightforward. Okay, now lasers is where a lot of people spend most of the time understanding different kinds of lasers. Photodetector, the idea is very simple. It's exactly the reverse process as an LED. So instead of having a forward biased P-N junction, you have a reverse biased P-N junction. Okay, and when there is a electron hole recombination, which is triggered by incoming photon, okay, So what is happening is that it's like an absorption phenomenon. So you absorb and you have recombination, and the moment you have recombination, this exists in a conduction band. You apply a reverse bias. As soon as this recombination occurs, there's a current, okay, and you pull, you have this thing, okay. So you can think of this like a photoelectric effect, okay. So it's very simple. So you want to have sufficient sensitivity to this process, okay. So the simplest thing you can do is you have a region where this recombination occurs. You have this photon absorption, which creates a free electron in the hole, and then you have electrodes on both sides. This positive side is attracted here, negative side is attracted here. Okay, this is called, this is not a photo detector in the classical sense, it's called a photoconductive detector. Okay. The problem is that this thing is not very efficient. Okay. But it has to travel a long distance to get to reach the electrodes. Okay, only when it reaches the electrodes will there be a current here. So before it reaches the electrodes, it could recombine again. So if there's a large region here, this could recombine, and then you essentially lose that effect. So so what you do is, the first thing you do is you try to make the gap very small. So you actually have a practical photoconductive detector where you have these electrodes very close, and they are sort of coupled with each other, and you have photons hitting this. And as soon as this happens, there's only very small distance between the electrodes. But you still have a high current, in other words, high reverse bias voltage. Okay. So coming back to the prior thing is, you need the incident photon to be at least the band gap energy. Remember that if you send a photon which is smaller than the band gap energy, nothing is going to happen. It'll just go, it'll be transparent to this whole thing. Okay, so in terms of that, the photo detectors are not often made out of silicon and gallium arsenide, so you typically use other materials like indium gallium arsenide and other indium based products. Okay, so now what we'll study is to look at more practical photodetectors, okay, such as spin diodes, spin photodetectors and avalanche photodetectors. Now, PN junction, as we saw, can be used in light emission as well as light detection, okay. It also turns out that you can use it for power production. So depending upon the IV characteristics of this, okay, in different parts of this, you can make it behave like a detector or an emitter or a power producer, okay. So Professor Partha Datta here, does research and all this stuff. So he doesn't build LEDs, so we have Professor Fred Schubert who works here on LEDs, but Partha Datta builds detectors and also emitters, like lasers for quantum dots and so on, and also photovoltaic or thermophotovoltaic type cells and solar cells and so on. So the same devices, which basic fundamental devices you build, can be used depending upon the appropriate biasing. Okay, so several of the sort of optoelectronic research in terms of sources detectors can be reused also in the context of power production or thermophotovoltaics, which is a very hot area now. Okay, so the basic parameter of a receiver or a photodetector is a parameter known as responsivity. So the idea of responsivity is very simple. I put some incident optical power on the device and I ask how much current comes out. That is responsivity. Okay, so it has a nice symbol called R, and the basic behavior looks almost like the inverse of the formula we saw earlier for LEDs. It has a direct relationship with lambda, and you have the by 1.24. If you remember the earlier formula, you had 1.24 divided by lambda for LEDs, so it's basically the opposite. And then there is a constant here, which is it's called quantum efficiency. So this number is usually engineered to be closer to 1, depending upon the device you build. You can engineer a lousy photodetector with smaller number, but the overall number that matters is this big number called resistivity, which is given by the simple formula. So if you discount this number and say you do good engineering, this is close to 1, so it basically depends upon lambda. Okay. So up to a point, so as you go to higher and higher wavelengths, you have better and better responsivity. So here's why you like to go to far infrared, because you can build better detectors for them, okay, more responsive detectors. Even for so far infrared, by the way, larger, even if I get a single photon, right, it has more energy. That's the basic idea in that if I go to farther wavelengths, so therefore they're more responsive. Okay, so the responsivity curves for real photodetectors behave like this. They have sort of a reasonably flat or near flat region, and then they drop off precipitously. Beyond that point, they cannot detect. So they only work up to a point, and that point usually depends upon the material characteristics of out of which the photodetector is built. Okay. So the particular class of photodetectors that are interesting for fiber optics as well as free space optics is something known as photodiode. Okay, photodiode is basically a PN junction which is not just a photoconductor. Photoconductor is just a semiconductor slab on which you put light and ask what happens. Whereas a PN junction is you have a P region, N region, and an active region or an intrinsic region onto which you shine the light. You shine the light only on the intrinsic region and then you ask what happens there. So the key idea here is that as soon as this the generated electrons, electron hole pairs show up, the current shows up, right? You want to sort of pull that current away into the electrodes. That's the idea. So the electron hole pairs, you want to essentially these are known as drift currents, and you want to rapidly sweep out the drift current into the electrodes, and then you want to get that. Otherwise, there's another kind of current known as diffusion current. Electron hole pairs, when light occurs in the particular region, you can light can also occur outside the region. I mean, light can also hit the material outside the region. And then in this diffusion type of currents move slowly, it doesn't reach the electrode fast enough. So when they move slowly, they might recombine with the other types of charge carriers that are hanging out there, so which reduces efficiency. So you'd like to maximize the drift currents, okay, and you want to make the device small enough so that it can quickly pick up even for small amounts of photons that come and impinge, you can basically detect it. That's the idea. So the usual rule of thumb we use is you need about 100 photons per bit. Okay, so you want to get at least 100 photons to know what is the to get to a threshold of energy of current so that you can say it's a one. Okay, so basic idea is to use a photodiode is a p-n photodiode that is reverse biased. You have p-type, n-type, and you at the junction you have a depletion region, and it's the whole thing is reverse biased. When light impinges, you have electron hole pairs, and then they are pulled into the appropriate appropriate regions. Okay, but in reality, you have these other regions too, and you can have diffusion processes here, which you want to avoid. So what you do is you want to create a very tiny region, okay, which is also called the intrinsic region. So you create a type of photodiode known as a pin photodiode, which has a small intrinsic region. Okay, now the pin photodiode essentially has a P region, N region, and I region. So the P and N are based are use the is the same material, but it has P and N characteristics. The I region is where you like the action to occur, and then you make these P and N regions very small, and the I region large. So because all the photons that come in, you want it to hit the I region, where you create drift currents, and you quickly cross this P or N regions and reach the electrodes. Okay. So another better design is to make the P and N region also transparent to the currents that are coming in. So if you use the same material here, remember that this kind of argument we saw also earlier in LEDs using a double heterojunction type design, the band gaps of the I region are smaller than the band gaps for the P and N region. So if you create an electron hole pair, they are sort of transparent, they just go through the other region. So transparent can be simply understood that if you create a particle that doesn't have energy at least equal to the band gap, then the particle just go through. So if you create a particle in the I region, it has small band gap energy and you've created it, it just go through the P and N regions. So this is a much more efficient photodiode. Obviously any photon that impinges will create this electron hole pair, it will go through a transparent P and N region out. Okay, that's the basic idea. Okay, so pin photodiodes are very popular, it's very cheap to do it, and we are also using it in our free space optical projects. Another type of photodiode which is popular in optical communication is avalanche photodiodes. So the basic idea of avalanche photodiode is the following. You have this intrinsic region where you create these charge carriers, and then you have a field where you accelerate the charge carriers. Okay, now and then it goes and hits a region where there are other charge carriers. Okay, so essentially you accelerate an electron, and the electron will go into a region and knock off other electrons, and the electrons which are knocked off will knock off other electrons. So you have an avalanche or a cascading effect, where a single photon creates an electron hole pair, and the electron hole pairs are suddenly accelerated, and then they knock off more, and then you get a larger current. Okay, so that's avalanche. Obviously, it has a huge amplification factor. Okay, now the only problem with this is it's a little bit unstable. I mean, it's very hard to control it beyond a point. It's like lasers, right? I mean, lasers at least you can control it because you know the cavity length and so on. This avalanche process is less. It's harder to control. You can only control the length of the gain region and the type of material over there and so on. Okay, that's the basic idea. So this region where you accelerate it is also known as a multiplication region or gain region. Okay, I think let's see if I can understand this. So you have one point where you have entering light. Let me see which is the amplification part. So. Yeah, I think, anyway, so one part, P region has been amplified. Okay, so I think this is the part where it gets accelerated and it sort of knocks out other electrons from existing atoms over there. Anyway, so this is one way you can think about it. So you have one region where you have acceleration, and suddenly you will get, even for small amounts of photons, you'll have a huge electric field strength that comes out. Okay, so I didn't talk about avalanche photodetectors more, but avalanche photodetectors also have a downside. They will also have noise. Even if there's some stray emission that is coming in from elsewhere, or there's stray spontaneous emission that and that causes an electron hole pair, that'll again be amplified. So it is very similar to the amplified spontaneous emission ideas we saw earlier, which is like noise. So avalanche photodetectors, even though they're very sensitive, they will also have this noise amplification problem, which has to be dealt with. Okay, but they are fairly popular. It's more costly than the pin photodiodes to do. Okay, so we will spend a little bit of time. I think we have 5 more minutes today on basic modulation ideas. The types of modulations which are very popular for optical communication is two types of modulation, which is known as RZ modulation or NRZ modulation. Okay, so it's basically it's like turning it on and off. That's the basic idea, but there's a little more to that than just turning it on and off. NRZ modulation is the most popular. NRZ modulation is as simple as it gets. Okay, if I send a 1, it's at high. If I send a 0, I turn it off. If I send a 1, it's at high and turn it off. Okay, unfortunately, you just can't turn off a laser, because lasing takes some time to build up, right? So if I turn it off, I will have to again have to go through the stimulation process, and there's some time. So the right way they do it is they will keep the laser and operate it beyond the lasing threshold, and then they will vary the power within that. If I essentially want to do a 1, I will have a much higher current, input current, so the power will be much higher, and then when I want to transmit a 0, the power will be much lower. So the ratio between these two powers is known as an extinction ratio. This is very important for understanding modulation. You need it to be at least 10 to 20 dB, otherwise you can't distinguish from a 0 or a 1. But the key thing, the problem with lasers, unlike LEDs, you just can't turn it on and off. If you want to do internal modulation, if you do external modulation, you can do more fancy things. You can actually kill the light and then open it up. So that's why external modulation have better extinction ratios than internal modulation in general. And internal modulation have other troubles as well. But anyway, in general light, the simplest modulation you can do is turn it on and off. But there are still two ways. Why are we interested in two ways? The RZ modulation, what happens is that you have a bit period that is much smaller. The actual light energy, right, which is on, off thing, right, occurs in a smaller period than the bit period. Okay. So why is this interesting? Because you have a transition. So even if I have a series of ones, right, I will have a small pulse here, then I'll have a small pulse here, have a small pulse here, and so on. So even a series of ones will have a bunch of pulses. Only a series of zeros you have to worry about. A series of zeros will pretty much have 0, 0, 0, 0. Okay? But a series of ones will always have pulses. So you always can, so it is easy to directly synchronize or extract the clock out of it on the other side. So you can synchronize in one of the issues in basic link level thing is to extract a clock. So RZ, you can extract a clock, but unfortunately you require a higher bandwidth. You see, whenever you go smaller in time domain, you have to go higher in frequency domain. So you have to go wider in frequency domain. You need more bandwidth if you want to do RZ. So NRZ is nice, you don't need that much bandwidth. You keep it one for the entire bit duration. But now you have the problem. If I have all of them are ones, what do I do? Or all of them are zeros, what do I do? So the answer is you scramble. Okay, so essentially there's a very simple mechanism where if I have a sequence of bits that are coming in, I have this magic number at which I XOR these bits. Okay, this is known as a scrambling polynomial. I XOR these bits. Whenever I XOR, I mean, if it's a 1, it's a 0. If I XOR 2 1s, it'll become a 0. It's like addition, right? So, and then the scrambling polynomial is well known on both sides. So after you scramble it, what comes out is very unlikely to have a long sequence of zeros or ones. So that way, you will guarantee that your clock will always have transitions of zeros and ones. So scrambling is a basic way to do that. Okay, but I mean, it can help you in that, but there are some other issues. The average power is non-zero, and these are some issues. Okay, we'll continue all this in the next class. Thank you.